Welcome to the Broadcast Sport Podcast. My name is Jake Bickerton. I'm the Editorial Director of Broadcast Sport. This podcast series brings you exclusive interviews with sports content makers.
I'm here chatting to Lawrence Duffy, founder and CEO of Aurora Media Worldwide. And we're focusing on electric racing today. I wanted first, Lawrence, to kick off with a bit of history about, you know, when it was that you first started getting involved in electric racing events.
So I think we're going back now. Thanks, Jake. And it's great to be here and fun to chat to you and anybody else who's listening. It's kind of a snapshot of 10 years of my life in a way. We started producing Formula E, as people now know the success that it's been, back in the first race was Beijing 2014, September. I remember it really well. We started work on the project in 2013, so almost a year before, and with the planning, and actually there was a tender process which we were asked to bid for among, as I recall, there were 15 other companies. So it's a really big kind of field.
Yeah.
And we hadn't started the company very long. Aurora was only probably about 6 months old. And I went into this process. As you go into these processes, you think, well, what are our chances? You look at the lineup. But we had a good team and we were producing Goodwood already. So we knew a little way around motorsport.
Mm.
And we bid for it, and eventually we won it, which was a little bit of a surprise at the time. I think it was a bit of a leap of faith. Aurora was not a lot of people knew who Aurora were. Mm. Fewer, or as few, or maybe a few more knew what Formula E was doing as it was. So it was kind of two startups at the time, and we got involved at that time.
Wow. What do you think it was about your pitch at that point that swung it?
It was definitely not my name on it. I think we benefited from, and actually one of the learnings of all this is that you don't do anything on your own in this business. So we had Mike Scott, who was exec producer, who had a kind of amazing pedigree in motorsport. Wes Gillett, who everybody, I think, knows of that similarly. Mm. Great director, great creative. Mm. And a great technical director, a guy called Lee Flay. So those were central to how we did things. And street racing was a bit different from track racing. And the boys had all done a lot of street racing. Well, quite more street racing than anybody else had done.
Hmm.
So I think that, you know, that kind of, you know, definitely helped. And actually, you know, if anybody wants a kind of, it's a tutorial, but for me, you know, one of the learnings and what I'm sort of proud of is those three are actually in Tokyo. Formula E is this week. So first time in Tokyo, amazing to be there, street race in Tokyo. And Mike and Lee and West, over 100 races on, are still doing it. So they've been, you know, central to, our position there. And that kind of loyalty and just endless love and creativity they bring, you know, over a decade is quite something, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the Formula E is obviously just grown and grown and keeps getting bigger and keeps adding new races, as you say, Tokyo this weekend. What's been, from a production point of view, the kind of key changes you've brought in along since, 2014, wasn't it? Since 2014.
Yeah, so I think, again, the sort of reflective of some of the vogues of broadcasting. I mean, this is its 34th, I read recently, its 34th city. So lots of, 34th venue, you know, lots of experience along the way. I think when we started, you know, it's funny looking back that even the left-hand column, the stack, as we'd call it, of which position the cars are in, we had this little icon. We thought about like a phone icon of a battery running out. We thought, wouldn't it be smart if we had this little icon? And it was green when it's fully charged, and then it goes to orange, and then by the time it's nearly finished, it's red. And we put this on screen, and at the time we thought, I wonder if this is going to work. And then actually it worked immediately, and people, you know, it was very relatable.
Yeah.
And then everyone just took that, and the drivers and the teams looked through it, and they began to talk to each other. Because I think one of the things that people don't realize about Formula E is when all the graphics and data go on screen, the other teams and the see it at the same time as the audience sees it. They don't have any insight before then. They know their own data of their own car's performance, but they don't know the data and the performance of the competitors on the track. So when they see this data land on screen, they are then calling their driver on radio talk by often saying, you know, Mitch Evans has got, you know, slightly less, you know, battery than you have, Sam, or whatever. So they've seen it on TV. So I think this kind of, and again, that's been a change with this kind of democratization and the opening up of sports for the athletes and the audience. So everyone's kind of in the same, feels like you're in the same game. I think that's been really sort of influential. And we were lucky because back in the day, again, we were just given the toolkit and said, you know, get on with it. You know, here's a budget, here's a plan. And also, we were also lucky in that we were slightly further up the food chain. We weren't just coming into an event to say, look, cover it, and that's it. We were like, what do you think of this format, guys? It's two cars to start with. There's going to be a car change, car swap in the beginning. And then latterly over the years, it was, okay, now we've got attack mode. The cars are going to come off the track. They're going to power up. What would that look like on TV? And so on and so forth. So I think the success of Formula E and the success of other events that we've been involved in and what I see on TV is often now this coming together where media and television producers are right in the mix at the beginning of the formatting as well as the event coverage, as opposed to maybe when I was younger, TV was just, okay, we've done the event, now we need TV guys come in and cover it. And I think that's a vogue which I've seen time and again. And then to your point, it just got bigger and bigger. We added more cameras. And then we got to camera inventory, which we didn't need any more cameras. Actually, last year there was a new onboard system done by Formula E and Eric and Timeline, which is amazing. You know, we've added helicopters. We've added one kilometer wire cam over the top of the racing, which was just a fantastic epic city shot, which again everybody got used to quite quickly. You add these things, and that's the next couple of races later, and we're just like, all right, we've got that now. What can we add next? And then the data unpacking has been, you know, what data is available? What are we sharing? Does it make sense? English language outputs, you know, different versions for different broadcasters. So again, you know, representative of broadcasters and audiences wanting just tailor-made content, you know, in the way the industry's gone.
And with that as well, the growth of social media and putting sports content out on different platforms, obviously TikTok's arrived since then as well. Has that all played into the kind of production content that you create?
Yeah, so I think what's happened there is that the big change that we didn't mention there is remote production. So
yeah, of course,
again, over 5 to 10 years and post-pandemic, you know, remote has accelerated. And rightly so, and for other sustainable reasons I'm sure we'll talk about. But what's happened is that, you know, if you go back 5, 10 years even, and this still happens, which is fine, but you have a kind of slightly linear truck scenario on site at a venue, and you have a production team that go into the truck, make content for that truck, and then it gets passed to a transmission center on site, and then it disappears. What happens when you're remote is the signals come back to a production center, and you've got more opportunity and bandwidth and control of being able to produce more in more and more short form or mid form or long form sizes and languages, just basically different offers, different products. So you can do all your social feeds, you can do all your YouTube and digital feeds, you can do all your broadcast outputs for in different languages. It's just easier to do from a centralized location. And I think that is a big change that we've seen. So moving from location to remote and centralized production just allows us to create more product faster for different platforms, for different audiences that are consuming in different ways. And again, we know from insights from any sport is that not every audience is sitting down watching the live game, the live match, the live race. and you know, all the way through the gens, from Gen X through to Gen Alpha, you can choose your consumption patterns. And Barry Flanagan gave this great phrase, as he often does. He said, "You know, have you heard about the crunch timers?" I was like, What are the crunch timers, Barry?" The crunch timers are the, forgive the Scottish, I'm Scottish as well, so I'm allowed to do this.
Yeah, you're allowed.
Crunch timers are the guys who just come in for the last 5 minutes. So it's like the younger audience just come for those moments in the output, but they can't really gauge, but they'll choose to come in for the last 10 minutes of the match or the penalty shootout or the last couple of laps of a race, because everyone's a bit more time poor. So it's just understanding or trying to predict where those audiences are. And if you can control your ecosystem, you've got more opportunities to create more for more audiences faster. And that's the other, I mean, productization of sport is one of the biggest changes that I've seen from a kind of commercial point of view.
Moving on to Extreme E, which was, you know, I don't know how many years after Formula E, but I'm guessing it's around 5 or 6. You can correct me when you do the answer. That was another, obviously, electric racing event that you were there right from the start of. So did you have to pitch for that? Because I know it's done by the same organisation that created Formula E, or was the relationship strong enough that they created this new event and thought, let's go to Aurora? I mean, how did you manage to land Extreme E as well?
The umbilical cord between Formula E and Extreme E was that we made a film, actually. I've almost forgotten what it's called. I think it was called Ice Drive, where we took a Formula One car to the Arctic, and we tried to find an iceberg to land the car on to showcase, you know, clean energy, electric cars, carbon emissions, etc. And we couldn't find an. So I went to Greenland with this Formula E car, trying to find an iceberg to do the stunt on, with Alejandro Agag, and Lucas Degrassi was driving the car. To cut a long story short, we couldn't find an iceberg because they were all calving and melting and going down the fjords to Iceland from Greenland. So we ended up driving the car on the Arctic Circle, which was a first, and you know, it was really super interesting. But I think what happened was it became a kind of personal odyssey and a professional interest that when Extreme E was launched by Alejandro and a chap called Gil de Ferran, who's sadly no longer with us, I really wanted to do it because I could see in the first trip we'd had what was happening with climate change. And also we'd had, I wouldn't call it a benefit, but having been around the world at that stage with Formula E for 5 or 6 years and working on a sustainable property like Formula E, everywhere we went, whether we were in Buenos Aires or Miami or Moscow or Berlin, or everybody said to us, "Oh my God, it's so hot here. It's like the hottest summer we've had. It's the hottest spring we've had, or it's the rainiest season we've had." Then I went to Greenland, saw this. Anyway, to cut long story short, when Extreme E came along, I went back to a place called Candelusac because I knew that was a plan to have the first race there. And we hadn't pitched for it. I just took myself there. Nobody knew I was going. I just took myself there. I took Lee Flay from Formula E, and I mapped the whole track. I worked out how many cameras we needed, and I began to learn about climate change. Then when I came back, I got really into data. So I was kind of reading NASA. I was reading this organization called IPCC, which is the Intergovernment Panel for Climate Change. And I began to understand, you know, just have more knowledge of what was happening. You know, statistics like the 10 hottest years since the Industrial Revolution, since 1850, have been the last 10 years. You know, so climate change was with us. I'd seen it anecdotally. Now I was seeing it factually. I was reading about it. So I just went into pitch to Extreme E and said, "Look, guys, I've been out here. I've done this. I've done that. I think this is my take on it. And we'd really love to do it." And, you know, and then everybody said, "How much?" And but we had a very good relationship, and I said, "Well, we just want to do it for, you know, we just want to get it right," which we did, even though it was during a pandemic. And so I suppose that we won it because we'd done the DD, and I was very passionate. I really wanted to go for it. I was like, this is a project that I'm just going to do the way I want to do it. And I could, Alejandro had a vision for it, and I could see that. Ali Russell, also central to it, huge vision for it. And I was like, right, this is what we want to do. So we ended up winning it, and we got on with it. And then we went to, the first race was in Alula in Saudi Arabia, in this mountainous region of in Saudi, which is north and northwest of the country. And when I got there, I thought I'd bitten off more than I could chew. The terrain was really the most difficult place you could ever try and do an outside broadcast in. Unfortunately, we had great partners in NEP who told me to, you know, calm down. And
it'll be all right.
And yeah. we ended up, you know, doing the show. So and the rest, you know, it kind of went from there. And but we did that remotely as well. That was the first sort of big, really difficult remote production, almost the most difficult remote production you could do. So we had, you know, people on site. We had people in London. We had another gallery in Hilversum in the Netherlands, which did all the ARVR graphics. And then we had another gallery in Barcelona. So we had four simultaneous galleries creating content in real time, coming back to London, mastering the show, punching it out to 50, 60 broadcasters, and under rehearsed because it was during the pandemic. So we hadn't really rehearsed the racing. But on the day, it came together and was pretty spectacular.
And what's the turnaround time for an Extreme E event?
So everybody, so similarly to Formula E, the crew will get on site at the beginning of that week generally. So if the race is on Saturday and quali's on Friday, people will get there on, well, actually the tech guys will maybe get there the Saturday, Sunday before, start unpacking all the equipment. And then the difference is with Extreme E, the equipment is by boat. But generally speaking, the same principle. And then the crew, the tech guys start to arrive Tuesday, Wednesday. Cameras arrive a little bit later. The specialist cameras that don't rig, the ones that dust off their waistcoats arrive on Friday or Thursday. And everything gets made on qualification, gets made on Friday, Saturday, and then and we start with Extreme E. It's a kind of a rolling edit where we're just producing content, and then we go live for the semis and the final. So, but more and more the sessions are like the live offer, but we do a 2-hour broadcast with everything, the best of the weekend packed into 2 hours, and then punch it out with the live racing on the back end of that 2 hours. On the last day of the race, which is usually Saturday or Sunday. So the only difference, Jake, is really that Extreme E can be a sort of best of off tape and then live. Formula E sessions are all live. Actually, Extreme E is done more and more live as well as the 2 hours. It just depends on what the broadcast inventory is and what the broadcasters are seeking. Some broadcasters will take all the live of all sessions for Extreme E and Formula E, and some broadcasters will take 2 hours depending on who they are.
And the St. Helena boat, I mean, this sounds very interesting. And obviously, it's got to get to these very difficult to access locations. So it's done in this big boat. So the cars are all on that boat, all the production equipment's on that boat. I mean, how does that impact on the production?
Well, I think when we were working out what equipment to take, you've got a hold of a boat to work with. So we had a space to work with.
Right.
And we were kind of retrofitting the equipment we needed into the space on the boat and the equipment we needed on site. So we knew that we couldn't take equipment that we might have. We couldn't take long lenses. You couldn't take box lenses, for example. Right. You know, we didn't want box lenses, but we couldn't have taken them even if we wanted to. So we couldn't take, you know, for those of you people who know listening knows what box lenses, a big, you know, like a football style lens. So we were taking long lenses, we're taking different types of cameras. And again, we weren't taking a lot of track cameras. We were smart about, we were taking mini cams. We embedded a lot of mini cams in the track. And also we put a lot of cameras on the cars to act as our kind of point of view cameras, not just looking into the car, but actually looking out to the venue so that we could see the venue without taking lots of track cameras. So, we were, I guess we were sort of, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And we had to think slightly outside of the box that we were given to put the stuff in the box that we were given to go with. But yeah. Again, that sort of begets this sort of sustainable thinking where you begin to think, okay, how many people do we need on site? How many cameras do we need? Are we being smart enough? Can we do this remotely? And because genuinely we'd seen global warming with our own eyes, we'd been around the world, we didn't want to take a lot of people. You know, actually, the Extreme E guys on site is still about 35 people. It's not a lot of people. It's a very, very small amount of people. Mm. And those people, everybody on Extreme E, again, to the great credit of Extreme E, all the drivers, all the execs, all the TV people, everybody involved in the event, they take their own cutlery, utensils, cups, bowls, so they don't have any plastic waste. They have no additional weight on the. It's as sustainable as it can possibly be. All the it's an amazing operation. Again, once you're in that environment, you just want to take that and kind of unpack it and just learn as much as you can about it.
Yeah, presumably that type of approach can influence the way you produce everything as well, can't it?
It does, yeah. And, you know, even to the toilets are compostable. So I'm not suggesting it's right for everything, but yeah, when it comes, you know, and then questions we ask ourselves all the time are, you know, how sustainable is this? And it's actually funny because, you know, we're not experts, you know, we're not scientists. But we do feel that, you know, we are trying to do our bit. I mean, you know, statistically, even with electric cars, if you know, looking back on Formula E and Extreme E, both electric vehicles, when we started Formula E, nobody gave it a chance. Nobody really bothered it, ever thought electric cars were sort of milk floats. You know, the global sales of electric cars, I looked it up recently, was like 0.01% globally.
Right.
It's now 15%. In the UK, it's 17% of all cars that get sold are electric cars. There's a million electric cars on the road in the UK. And, you know, the Formula E, you know, broke the world record for single-seater cars, 0.249 seconds, 0-60. Hmm. So I think we've tried to do our little bit in saying to everybody that's watching electric cars, these cars are rapid. You don't even need to go that fast, obviously, but you're just, everyone's just trying to do that. So I think we feel a little bit proud of, you know, yeah, we're just trying to do our bit.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, on that subject as well, you know, it's quite easy to convince people of the speed and, you know, everyone is going to naturally compare Formula E to Formula One, but, you know, they're really fast cars. The atmosphere is amazing. I was at Monaco last year at Formula E and it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I loved the 45-minute, you know, to finish. Yeah. So it's all action. The strips that you talked about before that you can drive over for that little gain that you get is really, really exciting as well. There's loads of overtakes. You're never really sure who's going to win. You know, there's a lot of jeopardy, which you don't necessarily get in Formula One. I kept getting told off for comparing it, but it's natural you will. But the one thing that everyone says when you come back, say, I've just been there, go, oh, yeah, what about the noise, though? And it's like, well, actually, I didn't really particularly notice the fact that it wasn't quite as noisy. But is that something that, you know, you constantly get asked about as well? And is there anything you can do to create a kind of slightly more noisy environment for hardcore petrol heads?
You know, it's a really good question. And I think, well, in answer to your question, Formula One, Formula E, I think there's room for the two of them. As is proven over the last 10 years and we've proven over the next 10 as well, I'm sure. I think for the noise again, you know, well, first of all, I'd say that visceral intimacy you have with any sport is really hard to create for TV. I've been doing this for a long time and you can create the vision, you can create the scenery, but actually finding, I mean, people talked about Dolby 5.0 and whatever cameras whatever sound we use, we're always trying to get really inside the sport. But that moment, any sport where you hear the thud of a tackle or you hear you're next to a, you know, a dive in the pool, you just get that kind of intimate relationship with the sport you're watching and because you're there. or even a football match, obviously, that is quite hard. Whatever anybody says, it's quite hard to replicate on TV. However, yes, we are always looking at ways of, you know, amplifying the sounds. Not the right. It's being true to the sound. I think it's being true to the sound of Formula E. And actually, with your ear locally, it's like as you probably would testify, it's a bit like a fighter jet.
Yeah,
it's just like it's gone. You know, it's like, yeah. Wow, what's that? Well, that's a car. So it's an endless pursuit of finding the authentic sound of Formula E. In the same way as the Formula One guys would probably say, we've got, because the sounds are often there's always changing there. It's trying to find the the nadir of the central part of what that is.
It's
never done, I don't think. But and you know, you've got, and then you've obviously you've got driver sound, you've got crowd sound, you've got all those, and you can hear the crowd in Formula E, in a way that maybe you couldn't hear on Formula One, just because of the nature of it, which is kind of fun in a way as well.
Yeah, that's true. It gives it a slightly different dynamic, doesn't it? Then we moved to last year, I think it was, or maybe even this year, for the first race itself, for the E1 series. So taking the electric racing to the water and these newly created boats. Again, looks amazing. I've only seen their promo video, because one of the interesting things about this is, because you're creating a whole new sport, a whole new type of vehicle, there's a lot of effort put into the kind of almost documentary style content before the race series even starts. Yeah. So to raise awareness of it. So you're producing that again. And do you want to tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got involved in that, and also what it is and what you're doing to produce the content?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I think again, you know, the learnings of Formula E and Extreme E are not lost on E1, where, you know, if you look at it kind of from a macro point of view, for sure, in the same way as Extreme E had this kind of hybrid storytelling, where it was telling stories of deglaciation, it was telling stories of deforestation, or just warming waters, climate change, etc. You can't do that solely and exclusively, because the audience wants to be entertained and they're prepared to take a lot of it. They're prepared to take some of it, but they don't want it central to the proposition. So it's finding the blend. So with E1, you know, as we know, ocean waters, warming waters, clear waters in coastal locations particularly, and the kind of deurbanization, if you want, of those coastal waters is really important to local communities. If you live by the waterside and you go out on the boat, you want to be in clear water, you want to feel like there's an ecosystem there. So similarly with Extreme E, there's a story to be told there, but there's also, really, when it comes down to it, and what we're doing, whether it's Formula E, Extreme E, or E1, it's about competition, and it's about character, and it's about race. So you know, similarly to Formula E, when Formula E started in Beijing back in 2013, Extreme E had its first race in Alula. We weren't quite sure about the performance of the cars, because we'd never really seen them in a racing condition before. And with E1, it's the same. And then when we went to Jeddah, we'd never really seen the boats kind of nose to nose in a competitive environment. And the guys, the pilots had been training in Lake Maggiore, and they'd done as much as they could to train in a non-competitive environment. The boats had been built. So Jeddah was the first time they'd really gone, side by side. And I have to say, a couple of the races we saw in Jeddah, I mean, it was a proper competition where they were cutting across the wash, getting to know the performance of the boats. The boats are really quick. They look fast on camera as well, which is really important as a TV spectacle. And again, that determines where you put your cameras and so on. So the competition itself was pretty fierce straight away, which was unexpected to us. It's teams of one male and one female, so gender equality, really interesting. And again, Extreme E has that as well. So that kind of dynamic gives you a kind of, you go to a slightly different place with a man and woman in the boat, and then to kind of like kind of just trying to work out how you how they would beat another pair. Editorially, that is just really vivid, I think, from a storytelling point of view. So that was really interesting, just starting. And the performance of the women was again with extremely pretty much as strong as the men. Really interesting. And then we were working out, okay, what are the points of the data of the boat and the performance of the boat that the audience wants to see? How quickly can it turn? In the wash that's given from another boat, does that slow? Does that is it like peloton racing and cycling or with cars? Can you draft if you're behind a boat, or is it actually worse to be behind a boat because you're fighting the wash of the boat in front? All of these learnings are kind of nascent learnings, startup learnings in race one. And actually the learnings double from race one to race two to race three. And you're right, we were very conscious, as we were in the other sports, that you know, this was you know, we're kind of breaking new ground, not just for, well, in some of, you know, equality, sustainability, but really new formatting and a new sport that we were trying to create with the rights holders. And in Jeddah, it was really interesting. But you know, Venice is a second race in about 4 weeks' time. That'll be super interesting as well, as we learn some more.
How long are each of the races on the E1 series?
So a day, it lasts a whole day, the racing. So again, it's captured in one day. Quali's on one day, and the racing to get to the final and the super finals is all across one day. So you make a mistake in the morning and it can impact your whole day. Same with Formula E. So it's quite, I mean, your experience, Jake, of, you know, being in Monaco, where you see it's sort of high impact, long day, and quite an intense day for whether you're an event owner, whether you're a pilot, a driver, a TV producer, you're there, you're like, you've got one go, boom. And if you step out of line in the morning or the afternoon, it might impact what you get at the end of the day. And that, again, is indicative, I think, what the audience is looking for. They just want to pretty high intensity race action, and it's kind of boom, boom, boom. The difference with Formula E to Extreme E to E1 and Sail GP similar is the races are quite independent. Races are 7 to 10 minutes. So your team's won, you've gone up the ranks, you take a rest, you recharge your boat, you go again. So it's kind of short form content creation. So you can bite size it if you wanted to.
Mm. Brilliant. We mentioned briefly earlier the need to have documentary content around the athletes for, I guess, all of these races, because, you know, at the moment, most of the people involved aren't as famous as the people in the equivalent, you know, motorsports or whatever the sport might be. Is that something that right from the start you've worked with the federations to, you know, work on how to build up, you know, that awareness of athletes as well as the sport?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, just a huge and fascinating area. I mean, first of all, if you go back a sec, I think that what we've done is kind of understood that, you know, the our approach to the live is that we have to work really hard with the live for the audience to understand how the sport works. So, you know, we've got onboard cameras, we've got lots of data, we've got drones, we've got, you know, every type of, the data is really important. Then we're into, you know, with Extreme E, we kind of hitting the button in terms of augmented reality and virtual reality, which was a breakthrough moment for us. And I think it's fair to say in motorsport, we're taking live data into a real-time environment, into a virtual environment. And the same with the E1, you know, we're meshing AR, VR, real-time action. And it's kind of game. It's commonly called gamification in the industry because it is gamification. So broadly, these new progressive sports, I've got to work that a little bit harder to for the audience to lean in. Yeah. If you're Alcaraz versus Novak in the, you know, final of the French or whatever, or, you know, or City versus United versus Liverpool of a few weekends ago. You could pretty much put six cameras on it. I know Sky put 24 cameras on it, but anyway, you could pretty much put six cameras on it, and you just lean in anyway for the innate drama, because that's a legacy sport that people are so inured to. Yeah. The new sports have got to work harder, and in the non-live, it's the same. Where, you know, some of the formats that we see in factual, you know, I saw something that drops on Netflix next week. It's the story of Man City winning the treble, last season.
Yeah,
you don't necessarily need to explain a lot about, you know, who the City players are to a Premier League, even a non-City fan.
Yeah.
But if you're doing a sport around, you know, if you're with respect to some of the lesser well-known drivers or pilots or sailors, or if you're in a progressive sport, you need to work that a little bit harder. But really, I think there's a propensity for those individual athletes, and it could be the same in triathlon and in swimming, there's a propensity in those sports for the athletes to know they've got to work that a little bit harder, and have a character built around them. So it's not that they're playing the part, they're still authentic to their sport, but they know they'll probably have to turn up a bit more for the audience to understand. I mean, a good example and a bad example. I was watching a Full Contact the other day on Netflix with Ellis Genge, who I didn't know so much about. England rugby player, and his backstory I thought was amazingly interesting. And now, even as a Scotland fan, I watch the England matches and I look out for Ellis Genge, who had a great Six Nations.
Yeah.
And I know a bit more about him.
Yeah, it does work. Definitely works. Yeah, in whatever sport it is. And, you know, I think with something like E1 series, because it's so visual and so exciting to watch, and as you say, it's very close, run very fast, that if you can couple that with the knowledge of some of the athletes, then it does hook you in, I think, and it, you know, it's likely to do really well, I think. I mean, on that subject, do you think electric racing will sort of gradually become as popular as kind of, I don't know how best to put it, but non-electric racing?
I hope so, and I think it's started its journey really well. I think there's a lot of advocacy for it at every level now, and I think people like, you know, I'm going to mention Alejandro Agag, who was obviously the founder of formerly back in the day, co-founder of Extreme E, and you know, E1 becomes, you know, this trinity, as you say, and there is this kind of appetite, I think, from the broadcasters to understand that those sports are the future of a lot of what we're going to be looking at in the next 10 to 20 years, both in my generation and the next generation coming. The technology involved in those sports is going to continue to grow up, and the adoption of that technology is going to be more every day. So I think there's an inevitability that in racing electric boats and cars, that will hopefully sustain itself. And in fairness to Formula One and, you know, the other brands that are out there, I think they'll continue to grow as well. And at the end of the day, it's really about the athletes and the storytelling, because at the end of the day, no matter what tech, what data, graphics, backstory, factual, you know, companion programming you make, it's got to be about the athlete's story. I mean, you know, Patrick Mahomes, my son was watching Quarterback the other day. I didn't know anything about Kansas City Chiefs, and I started watching that film, and I thought, wow, this is a brilliant show. Maybe I'll just dive into NFL for a while and see where I get to. Yeah. So it's got to be about the story and the athletes, and kind of almost irrespective of where we're at. And it's, you know, it's, I guess it's people like me and you that try and help them find their way.
Brilliant conversation. Thanks so much, Lawrence. We're way beyond what we'd normally do for one of these podcast episodes, but I think it's brilliant. There's a lot to talk about, and you know, it's an important subject as well, and you know, very interesting from a production point of view as well. So is there anything else you want to add that we haven't covered already?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, it's been a pleasure to do it. And, you know, thanks for taking the time. And if anybody's listening, you know, good luck with what we're all doing. And, you know, we're all in it together. I think it's been, the industry we're in is a fun industry. It's super competitive between the rights holders, between the broadcasters and between the indies. But it's, you know, it's as much a joy to do it as it is the challenge of getting it done. So, you know, I'm thrilled to be still doing it.
I think that passion comes across, Lawrence. Yeah. Thanks so much for sparing the time to chat to us today. Mm-hmm.
All right, Jake. All the best. Awesome.
Thanks. Same Cheers. To you, Lars. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye then.
Thanks for listening to the Broadcast Sport Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe, and we'll see you soon for the next episode.